Everybody, welcome to the Speakeasy Podcast. My name is Kate.
My name is Alan, and we are from ReverseThieves.com. If you would like to contact us, just send us an email at ReverseThieves@gmail.com. You too can influence the podcast.
I mean, we could use some suggestions, unless people want this to turn into the podcast about, like, Critical Role, Scrubs, and Burn Notice, then, like, we always need more things to watch or read so that we can, you know, put them out there for you.
I could just turn this into the fake Grand Order. I could be like, man, there's some spoilers I found out, and let me tell you about that last event. But nobody wants that. Well, some people want that. Kate doesn't want that.
I mean, yeah, I feel like that would be a very popular podcast. It's just not a podcast that I can participate in. So this month's episode, we're just doing a little catch up. So, you know, we've gone back and watched some things or rewatching stuff. So it's just the time to kind of just catch all of what's been going on that is anime related. So none of the topics at the beginning of this podcast will be discussed. I promised an on-topic podcast, and it's going to happen. So we are going to start with fan favorite JoJo's Bizarre Adventure. I have been watching. I know Al watched them as well. The Thus Spoke Rohan OVAs, which are on Netflix. There's just 4 episodes. And you know, they really pack in a lot in those stories Rohan is telling people that happened to him allegedly. I like am not 100% convinced that he actually tells any truth in this OVA, but like I guess I could be interpreting it wrong. What do you think, Al?
I just feel like it's twofold. Rohan has such a weird life that I can't. It is not out of the question that any of those stories happened to him, but Rohan does seem like the type of person who would make up stories just to see if you believe them, and actually had crazier adventures that he didn't tell you about.
I don't know. I don't know how you get, like, we have this sort of kind of like almost like the first story is like this sort of like long meandering tale of like this guy and his identity, and like it really takes a while to come together of like what the twist is. Then we have an episode where there's a lot of stuff that happens in it. It's a murder mystery, sort of, but also I just remember it because Rohan buys a mountain or whatever with all of his manga money. Like, he makes so much money, which it must be an Iraqi, like, joke for sure of, like, Rohan's millions or something. I don't know.
But then he's immediately bankrupt in the next. He's like practically bankrupt in the next episode.
Yeah, then the next one is like involves a fitness god and Rohan being incredibly athletic and competitive for no reason, which, I mean, that totally tracks. Like, Rohan is absolutely competitive for no reason in the regular series and is such an asshole about it. And then, oh, and then the last one is like a secluded community where they have like really strict rules. I can summarize it. I feel like it might be a spoiler, but I would summarize the final episode as, eat this cob of corn correctly or this woman dies is the final story. So, you know, it's a real mixed bag of bullshit, and it's very JoJo's what the fuck, like the most like what the fuck of JoJo's, don't you think? I mean, maybe not the most extreme, but it's like really fits in with the weirdest stuff.
It feels like a bunch of stories that Araki wanted to fit into a regular JoJo storyline, but like they were all too weird to be like to fit in with a like ongoing narrative, so we just save them for like a Rohan story.
I mean, I know that you have said, Al, that part four does have a lot of weird stories that they kind of sort of
Cul-de-sac.
streamline a little bit, right? But like in the anime, they sort of smooth it out a little bit. So do you feel like these sort of fit in with those weird side stories?
I wonder if they were. Yeah, it does feel the more cul-de-sac-y parts of part four. Although I don't think we lost that many of the cul-de-sac stories. They just smoothed them out a little bit. I just wonder if like there was like Araki was like, ah, there's no way to fit this idea in like part five or part six or even part four. So I'll just make it a Rohan story.
And I don't know if you know this, Al. I didn't look it up. Are there more Rohan stories or are these the only ones? Because I'm pretty sure that the OVAs, the numbering is weird. Like it's not story one, two, three, four. I think like one of the stories is like nine or something.
I'm pretty sure they're like Rumic Theater. As Al whips out his overabundance of Rumiko Takahashi knowledge. So, Rumiko Takahashi usually works in Shonen Sunday, but she does this series called Rumic Theater in like their like older magazine, and she'll just do them whenever. Like there's no consistent schedule for Rumic Theaters. It's just like, I want to do one, here's a Rumic Theater, or oh, Takahashi said that we really need like something to fill this like gap because like it's not just one person didn't put in their submission. Like we have like three people out. Could you pad a little? We'll have like some. We'll give somebody a one shot. And could you do a Rumic Theater? I think the Rohan stories, they might still be in the same Ultra Jump magazine, but I think they're basically like super sporadic in whatever magazine they're in, and they're just basically like when he has a chance to do one. So I think there are more of them, but I think there's also not like a set schedule that they come out, they just do when they do. And I think this is probably just like a collection of a few of them. So I guess like there could be a Thus Spoke Rohan too.
I would love that. Of course, I really enjoyed them. Rohan is one of my absolute favorite JoJo characters. And I do think it's so interesting. I know, Al, that you have sort of said this, that Araki's always like, Rohan's such an asshole. Why does everybody like him? But he also draws more Rohan stories than anything else besides like, just like canonical JoJo, like when there's like a side story, it's a Rohan story. So obviously Araki has a fondness for him as well.
He has done a few like random Jolene stories, like Jolene Goes to Gucci or one. Other than Jolene, Rohan's only the only one who really gets. I mean, he even did when he did that. The Louvre had a bunch of comic artists. The character who is in his one shot for the Louvre is Rohan.
Yes, I was thinking of that too. Yeah, I think he's a great character. Also, he is voiced by one of my favorite voice actors, so it makes it extra special that they did all these OVAs. So I would definitely tune in for more of these if there were any, but I also think like if you enjoyed Rohan, if you enjoyed part four, I think that, you know, you would enjoy these. There's nothing, I mean, they are very weird. And I did find myself saying, like, what the actual fuck is going on multiple times. But, you know, in that loving way that you say it about JoJo's.
The only thing I say, which is interesting that you didn't know, is not that this isn't present in the main series, but I do feel all of the Rohan stories have a little bit more of a horror emphasis than normal JoJo's. I mean, JoJo's definitely dips into horror, but I felt like all of them felt like they could be part of like a somewhat like Twilight Zone or Tales from the Crypt kind of anthology series. Because I can't think of anyone that didn't at least have at least somewhat of a horror-y vibe to it.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I do think that it's mitigated a bit by Rohan's voice and also bookended usually by him starting to tell the story or like characters showing up and being like, did that really happen to you? Like there's some play in it. So I think that I definitely see what you're saying. Sometimes it's like grotesque or like very, very weird. But it was also, I don't really like that, but I felt like I was okay with it in this context.
I mean, it's a very distinctly JoJo's take on horror. But, like, I mean, like, the one with, like, the millionaire's mansion, and as you said, like, eat this corn correctly or this woman dies. I mean, that feels so much like a Twilight Zone or, like, a Tales of the Crypt episode.
But also so silly.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it's still very much JoJo's horror. Like, once again, or even, like, you know, Rohan at the gym.
You guys, that might be my favorite one. It's just so, and I'm like, because people have joked about the gods of fitness in JoJo's, but then one actually appears. I guess the horror-esque parts, Al, kind of just reminded me of, because occasionally I feel like main canon JoJo's dips,
oh, yeah,
that goes that way a little bit. So I feel like it wasn't, to me, wasn't any further than any of those sometimes go. Because like I feel like it's such a variation, at least in what, part one through five. So like it definitely was, I think you're right, it's definitely in the more bizarre realm.
Yeah, I don't think I'll throw anybody off who's into the main series. I just thought it was worth noting just because it's interesting. It's a bit, they have a very similar thematic feel as opposed to like jumping around all the, I mean, other than like the goof-a-doof end cap stuff.
I also just at the end of this want to call out one of Rohan's amazing outfits in these stories, where I think it's in the last one where he's wearing like this like neckerchief / belt around his neck that has like this giant pin nib pendant on it. it's really special. But okay, actually speaking of the horror or like the kind of the various tones we can get in JoJo's, what did you feel like the tone is in part six, Al, which just got announced for anime?
So I do feel it's a little bit of one of those like a prison break escape kind of thing. And a little bit of Rikkyo with the whole, like, crazy fights in a prison. Or this I know Rikkyo also, like, once they get out of the prison, the tone changes a little bit, but I don't. I only basically know the movie, which is only set in, like, the initial Rikkyo prison arc, and then, like, where that series goes from. I just know that it goes different places once they get out of there, but I don't know too much about Rikkyo beyond that point. But yeah, I'd say a prison break with a little bit of prison exploitation.
Then how much of the bizarro horror, what kind of stuff like that?
I mean, there's some interesting. It's definitely in there. It depends on like who they're fighting and what part of the story they're in. It does have one of the two of the like most overly complicated stands in the series, and that's even after part five. But
I still don't understand what Giorno's stand is. Like, I just don't know. It's like, it doesn't, I can't understand it at all.
like this the I mean, this is only a minor spoiler. Like there is the infamous Feng Shui stand in part six. It is thankfully just in a one-off villain, but like it is probably the most like overly complex stand in all of JoJo's. Plus it assumes that you have a basic like I live in an Eastern country where Feng Shui is a thing that like people kind of know about, which does not help at all. But even like people who grow up in that culture are like, man, this dance is overly complex. But one thing I did want to mention, which was interesting, since we brought up Stone Ocean, which would not be as apparent if you to a modern audience who doesn't know about the whole history of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, is that like JoJo's Bizarre Adventure takes place, part six takes place in the early 2000s, which you're like, all right, why is Al mentioning this? It's important because it started in the late 90s, so it was technically in the very near future. Let's because like Araki wanted to like talk about like flying cars or anything, like not there's nothing weirdly technological. It was just to have Jolene, the main character, be the right age. He had to put it a few years into the future to line up with the JoJo's timeline, so it technically took place like a few years in the future, but at this point that's the past, and so you might easily think, yeah, nothing of it. And once again, it doesn't majorly affect the story. I just wanted to throw that out there as a minor PSA that it was te when it was written, that was technically minorly in the future.
Interesting. I wonder if they'll even say when it is. I'm trying to remember if they've. Do the others. I'm trying to remember if the other parts have dates in them at all, which I can't remember.
I definitely remember them mentioning that part three was in the 80s. Oh, and they have to have mentioned that part four is in 1999, because that's the one of the opening songs has the line, like the bizarre year of 1999. So if nothing else, I definitely know that three and four mention when they happen.
Well, I think I speak for a lot of people that I have been waiting for part six. I have been eagerly anticipating it, and it's finally announced. A lot of people are very excited for Jolene. I am one of those people. I am very pleased that I will finally get to, find out what this arc is all about.
Joke I've heard a few people is people are super excited about six because that means they can get their Steel Ball run quicker.
Well, I was actually going to ask, what's going on in current JoJo's?
It seemed like it was going to wrap up soon. But there might have been, I'm like a few chapters behind. But there, I think there might have been some revelations that means that this arc, that people were wrong about this being, like it might be ending endgame, but like people thought like the last guy was the big bad, but that might not be the case.
Well, it feels like they are at this point going to continue. I think there was a lot of questions after part five. It was a very long stretch before they announced part six, where they had sort of prior to that really announced them pretty in a pretty timely fashion. So I think there were a lot of questions of like, oh, are they going to continue? And it, you know, now that they have, I feel like that gives us hope for all of JoJo to eventually be animated.
I at least say they, I would be shocked if they didn't do Steel Ball Run, considering it's one of the more popular. I'd probably say after part three is probably one of the most popular parts of the series, so.
And it just feels like the staff has such a fun time. I just can't imagine they're not having a great time, you know, creating these in animated form. So
I decided to kind of have all of my three shows have a vague connecting tissue. Not like a really good one, but like vague. So all three of my shows are shows that came out and I didn't watch them when they came out because they came out at weird times on Netflix. So I went back and watched these series on Netflix and they all start with the letter D. This isn't super important, but what do you call it? I don't know. I like a weird theme. Even if it isn't the most cohesive one. These things make me happy. So my first one of the big D on Netflix, as they say, is Drifting Dragons. I think all three of mine are also based, I don't know about Dragon Pilot, but I know two of mine are based on manga. I'll look this up before I mentioned the other one, but Drifting Dragons is interesting. I remember some people talking about the manga. I will mention right off the bat that it is done by Polygon Pictures, so it kind of has that like kind of awkward like Japanese CG. There's not that many big action sequences. There are a few, I mean, but it's not like the worst series to be in that style, but I mean, I know certain people kind of hate that style, and I mean, I feel like it didn't do the show any favors, but I also didn't feel it ruined my experience, but I just felt like I should mention that off the bat, that it is kind of the cheapola Polygon picture CG all the way through. But, so the story is, in this world where there's kind of almost like a, I've never played it, but it seems like a very Skies of Arcadia world where there are all these airships and, you know, lots of like islands in the like floating islands, but there is also like land-based stuff, and it centers around a crew that are dragon hunters. They basically will hunt dragons for like fuel and food. You know, there's all these things that are made from dragon scales or dragon oil, and dragon meat is considered a delicacy. but the company that we look at is kind of one of the smaller, like the big companies that hunt dragons, and you know they're very well to do, whereas this is kind of a smaller, kind of down on their luck, paycheck to paycheck kind of crew. Like they're always looking for their next hunt, you know, just to keep the ship afloat and, you know, keep everybody paid. And the main girl is Takeda, and she's a new, she's like the newest member of the crew. So everybody else is kind of maybe not old hat, but at least has gone on, you know, has been at least with the crew for a few years. But our main girl has gone on a few hunts, so it isn't like her first day, but she's still definitely like the most junior crew member. So she's still like learning the ropes. People are still like informing her of stuff, or maybe explaining stuff to her and the audience at the same time. But she's not like a complete noob. And the other main dude is Mika, who is like everybody else, it's a job to him, it's hobby job. He's like obsessed with like eating dragon meat, and like you kind of get the feeling that if they just paid him in steaks, dragon steaks, he would do everything else for free. Their kind of interactions, and like it's very like a crew thing, but those are the two like main characters. Very episodic, you know, it'll be like there are a few like multi-part episodes, but it's like essentially what kind of dragon are they hunting this week? And then, you know, with like one or two 2 to 3 episode stories. Like this one episode that where they land in a town, and that's like I think 3 episodes. And one episode where the main Takeda fills off the ship, and that's like 2 or 3 episodes. But most of them are like one-off, and will like focus on a crew member or something like that. It's like an interesting show. Like the dragons are not have all very different kinds of like body shapes. They don't necessarily look like, you know, the classic Western kind of giant lizard. Nor are they like the very serpentine Asian dragons. There's like a whole bunch of different types of dragons. There'll be like round ball, kind of like floating ones, kind of more like flying needle types. They're all called dragons, but they are a bunch of very unique take on dragons. That's also worth noting, that they're not like they're very imaginative, different looking dragons. It's a nice ensemble piece. And also, once again, like I said, because they're kind of the small crew, you know, and the, like the accountant guy is always like, no, we've got to like hunt this type of dragon because we need like really to up the profits, or we got to go over here because this kind of dragon is in demand. And it kind of has a little bit of a Cowboy Bebop vibe because they're always, you know, chasing the next paycheck to paycheck. The one thing that really struck me, that didn't like prevent me from watching it, but just made me think and made me feel a little uneasy, was because, especially since there's so much of this world that at the time uses like dragon oil, and the fact that they specifically mentioned dragon oil and other dragon parts, it does kind of have this wailing feel to it. Plus the whole, the way they like hunt with these like shock harpoons and then like explosive harpoons, it does much feel like a whaling ship. And, you know, Japan is one of the few countries that still hunts whales. Like almost every country has banned that. And, you know, the official party line is that they only hunt whales for scientific purposes, but that's clearly not fully the case. And it's very controversial. And I'm not super comfortable with it. And part of the just the Japanese still hunting whales. And then, like, they do kind of bring it up and, like, the whole thing where Takeda feels off the ship and kind of like befriends this little baby dragon and like does have like a con like a kind of like has to think about if hunting these dragons is right. It feels very much like, hey man, hunting dragon whales is cool. But I mean, I realized that like there's much less of a problem with that. I mean, obviously not all Japanese people are cool with it, but I just feel like culturally it's much more normalized. So, you know, how much do you want to criticize something that's normalized in another culture? I mean, you could criticize it, but
Well, then what do you think what purpose did you think was served by the character who has a conflict of conscience? Did you feel like they were like, no, it's all cool?
well, I mean, she kind of comes to terms with it and continues to be a dragon hunter at the end. I think she just has more respect for the dragons at the end, because she's like, little baby dragon who saved my life, I'm gonna wait till you're old enough to hunt. So, you know, and sorry to spoil that storyline, but ruin it. But I felt that it is worth mentioning, and like. You know, it did make me feel a little uneasy at points. Not enough to stop watching the show and not enjoy it, but like, it did pop into my head. Felt definitely worth talking about on the podcast. And I feel like I know like at least one or two people would be like, good day, sir, and just walk out on the show because of that. And I'm not sure how much. Even the show, I think they wanted her, the character, to have a conflict more than maybe they wanted to examine if whale hunting slash dragon hunting is wrong. I mean, I've also never seen any interviews with the author, so I could be wrong about that.
I mean, well, like, they're not hunting whales, they're hunting dragons. And obviously, you're talking about the like real world parallels. Are there parallels in the story of like conservation? Are dragons like gentle creatures? Are they, dying? I don't know. Is there any like sense in the world that like,
There is a distinct feeling that, like, there are a lot of them out there, but there is this idea that they are kind of harder and harder to hunt, that there are less of them. And, like, you know, they do mention, especially in that episode where they, like, the like, probably the longest storyline where, like, they stop into a town, the, like, the, you know, the big companies. Are you know they're one of their problems is since there are less whales that the big companies are kind of pushing them out because they have more of a monopoly on the you know the lanes that are left. So you know I think that also didn't help like bring up the parallel in my mind.
and is this an ongoing series?
I mean as far as I know this was like a the manga was still at least there was still more manga it didn't like it wasn't like clearly the unless that was the last story in the manga and I don't know about it.
No, I was just curious because, I don't know what the through line is.
So yeah, the manga's still ongoing. The anime doesn't have a big conclusive like ending. It's just like, ah, this was a story, and their dragon hunting continues. I will say randomly, it does have the very rare instance of a male character who has a romantic parting and thereby gets a haircut.
Ah.
As I know you are someone who is keenly aware of that trope with girls.
I have seen it in a couple of shoujo manga for of guys doing it too. But yeah, it is much more rare.
But he didn't shave his head. I've seen it once or twice where they do the shave head. He just gets a shorter haircut.
Well, he was only a little bit heartbroken.
Well, it wasn't like they parted on bad terms. He just had to like leave the city, and he promised that, he would see her again if he came back. So,
So, would you watch more of this if there was more of it?
yeah, I enjoyed it enough. I had to bring up what kind of made me uneasy because I feel like. I mean, if it did do that to me, I think I would be negligent not to bring it up.
Yeah, I don't think I would be. I'm like not interested now that you have said that. Because I have seen the manga, because the manga has really beautiful art. It often reminds me of like a Nausicaa-esque like look to it, but yeah, whaling, not so much.
Yeah, that's also, I think, one of the main problem, one of the saddest things about Polygon Pictures getting it. I don't feel like they ruined it, but man, if they had been able to at least capture some of that art style in the anime, ah, man, it would have been really beautiful. Like, I don't feel like it ruined the story, but it's another thing I had to bring up that, like, ah, man, could have been cooler show, could have been cooler. So, I will piggyback on Drifting Dragons by talking about a different dragon show. Dragon Pilot, Hisone and Masutan. And this was a series that like I had heard a bunch of good reviews of, and like I was like, oh man, we should watch it for the blog.
The original series came out in 2018, but I don't know when it came to Netflix.
But I just say I remember when we talked when it originally came out. I remember we were all hyped to watch it, and then we found out, oh, it's Netflix, so it's not gonna come out for like forever. But it was in the back of my head, and then because of everything that was going on, I had a bunch of free time, so I was like, let me go back and watch this show that I heard a bunch of good things about. So, I finally went back and saw the show. Very interesting. So, we start off, and our main character, Hisone, is she's working like a, she has like an office job with the Japanese Self-Defense Force. And she's like, as like nobody where she's currently working in is really like talking to her, listening to her. And it turns out that she's just a human being who can't help but be blunt and tell people what's on her mind. And so basically, she's kind of alienated everybody where she currently works. And so she gets a transfer, and like basically like no one in where she works comments on it. It's just like, oh, she gets the message, and like she doesn't really say goodbye to anybody, and nobody really says goodbye to her. And it turns out that she has been selected to be a dragon pilot. So it turns out that there's a secret division of the Japanese Self-Defense Force that knows that dragons are real. And for various reasons, which I won't go into because they're major spoilers for the series, they need women to be dragon pilots. They basically, dragons will swallow the women and they will fly the dragons inside of them. But, you know, if people see dragons flying around, it breaks the secret of dragons. And so they specifically put this armor on the dragons so they can transform into, it's been other things in the past, but now they transform into basically modern fighter planes. And the one of the pilots, the pilots, the dragons, she got married and is retiring. So they're, what do you call it? They're having Hisone come in and pilot Masotan, who is, what do you call it? The current dragon who needs a pilot. And then the rest of the series is her getting to know the other dragon pilots and this one girl who is kind of like the backup pilot that she beat as the pilot for Masakan. So since she beat her, like, this girl really, like, hates her. And then, like, the... And it's also, like, learning, you know, why they have to keep the dragons secret and, like, what they, what purpose they serve. But I won't go too much into that because that's, once again, kind of the big secret of the show. But that's kind of, they hint at a lot in the first half, and then the second half is a lot more devoted to, you know. The first half kind of introduces just the general thing and all the dragon pilots and the cast, and like hints at the second half, and then the second half is more about like why these dragons exist and have to be kept secret. And the secret of why they choose their dragon pilots that they do. Hisone is an interesting choice for a main character, just because she is like a working woman in the military. Which I feel like, I mean, there've been several series in the past of anime with that, but it's uncommon enough that it's always worth mentioning when a title is about like a adult woman in anime, and like her, and you know, it's about dragons and stuff, but it's also as much about her career and her awkwardness with people. Because she is a very kind of, like, she's very likable, but she's also very deliberately an abrasive character who, like, is meant to put her foot, like, in her mouth a lot of the times. And she almost feels, the only way I could put it is Seinfeldian. Like, she clearly creates half the problems that she gets herself into. But I feel like you get enough to know her. And, like, she's never a malicious person. Like, so she's not, like, she's still very likable. But, like, you're like, ah, I know how you're going to sabotage yourself this accidentally while, you know, having good intentions. And, ah, you did. My major complaint is the ending is rather abrupt. Like, I feel like it's this very deliberately, slowly paced show that kind of like slowly unveils the secrets and is like feels very relaxed. And thereby, the ending just feels very like, oh, and here's the big plot. And, all right, and here's this stuff, and here's the ending. And here's an epilogue. After the credits. And it's very short. And the end. And you're like, whoa! Why did you just decide to pick up in the last half of the last episode, show? Because you seem to have a very measured pace up until this point where you decided, I guess we gotta wrap this up. And what? We've only got half the episode of the last episode left? It wasn't like a deal breaker, but it's definitely worth noting that, like, for a show that's deliberately paced, you decided to, like, Micro Machines Man through the end of this, huh?
How Mario Okada is this show?
Oh, like you could tell by like all the awkward romances of people that man, this is pretty Mario Okada. I think it's not her best work, but a solid work from her. I feel like I've said in the past, her work depends very much on how much she gels with the rest of the staff, and the rest of the staff gels with her. And so I feel like there's pretty good synergy going on. So it's pretty enjoyable. But it does, I mean, it does have her thumbprint on it, undoubtedly. The opening and ending also super stand out to me because the opening has this very kind of like bombastic kind of orchestral, it kind of almost feels, especially with the art style, a little Ghibli-y. And then the ending has this pop French, because it is in French and has this pop French song where all the characters are like dancing in this kind of like new wave French style. It's definitely a memorable kind of catchy ending. But yeah, it definitely has a very kind of almost like office comedy vibe in the first half, and then kind of a fantasy feel at the end. But I mean, I feel like the first half definitely, you, I mean, since they're in transforming dragons, it's not like it was all military base office company, and then the dragons just come in halfway through, and you're like, what? This is a fantasy series out of nowhere. And it's not like the office stuff disappears in the second half. The two halves definitely have like, the percentage focus is definitely different in both parts. But I enjoyed it. I just wish the ending wasn't as abrupt as it was in the second half. And I do feel like the main character being unique in her style, I feel, is definitely a interesting selling point.
Okay, I don't really have a segue for this, so we're just gonna take a detour back to 1977, in the middle of this podcast to talk about Voltes 5.
Oh, the ending song has a very like French 70s feel, so there you go.
Okay, yes, that's a perfect transition to giant robots. Pre-Gundam giant robots.
And the dragons turn into jets, so that's kind of mecha-esque. Okay, so you see?
We planned it all along. As I mentioned, this is a pre-Gundam giant robot series, and it is from a director that I feel like those in the robot know or whatever know. His name is Nagahama, and he directed these three robot series that are they're not related to each other, but they're like talked about together. So there's Combatler V, Voltus 5, and Deimos. And these are known as the Robot Romance Trilogy. So I have never seen Combatler V or Deimos, but I decided to watch Voltus 5 because it was kind of recommended to me and I've seen clips of it. And different people have differing opinions about which of the three is the best, but this was an opinion I trusted, so this is the one I watched.
Is Combatler V the one that like changes directors halfway through and has a very different, or am I thinking of a different robot show?
I don't know if it changes directors, but I do know that it has a very distinctive first part and
Hmm.
second part.
Right. That's what I'm thinking of.
I may it might. I don't know enough about it, but I do know that bit. So Voltus 5 is like very consistent, and I actually think that it's actually like it's really good. I thought it was really great actually overall. It's typical in that it's fifth I think it's 50 or is it 40 episodes? It has a little bit of a dip in the middle. Like, I just want to, is there any like robot show that's longer, that's like extra long that doesn't have some sort of slight dip in the middle of it? But so I think that the series starts out really strong. It's a very melodramatic show from the very beginning. It's about there's three brothers and then there's like like the Joe or like the Lance friend slash rival who is part of the team and like sort of scraps with the leader. And then there is Megumi, who is like she's the best character. She's also a pilot, but she is the daughter of one of the generals in like the military, and so she's also a part of this project with this giant robot that's going to defend the Earth from an alien race. And but there's a lot of like melodrama from the very beginning because the brother's father has disappeared because and he was like important to like the development of this robot. He's like gone away. And a huge portion of the series is them trying to figure out what happened to him. And then once they sort of start to put those pieces together, like how he is connected to this alien race that is invading the Earth. And yeah, it just like has like more depth than you might imagine it to have. And I think it like addresses like systemic racism and oppression and like caste systems. And it has a really great villain that is a recurring villain who is from the alien race, and he's a prince and he just like hates everything. Like he's just as like one of those like very angry characters. Like I was describing him using a more modern equivalent is like he's like Zuko from Avatar if Zuko was n like never noble. But like that sort of I'm mad all the time character. That's Heinel is the villain. And sort of how he's connected to like the bigger story and like what his relationship is to the ruling class in on the planet of Bo-Azan is like is all like very interesting. There's a lot of death. That's 70s robot shows for you. Like, there's collateral damage, but there's also like main character deaths and very, very dramatic ways. And it has like a very tragical ending in the absolute best way possible. So I feel like it has just a lot of the melodrama that I am looking for and like a lot of just like character stuff in addition to being like giant robot fights monster every week kind of stuff. Megumi is probably the best character in the whole show. She is not only a robot pilot, but she's also a ninja from the Koga clan. And her father is also basically like a ninja general. And he's like this really like stocky, like square dude, but like he does these ninja moves and it's just it's really entertaining. And like you're like, how did that man do that? He doesn't seem like he would be that dexterous, but he is. And yeah, Megumi, very rarely a damsel in distress. She has some really great lines. She puts people in their place. And I like really deeply love her and I will remember her forever. So I think that she was like such a great heroine to have. And she's not a romantic, like she's not a, there's like a little bit of hints of romance for her, but not really. So she's not just there to be like the girl that people fall in love with or have to save. So I thought that that was refreshing.
Is Prince Hainel like the first one in the robot romance trilogy to be like the like super handsome bad guy, or is that
that's Combadler V?
Right. I'm trying to remember if this was the one or was there a similar character in Combadler V?
There is, but I think Hainel is a like I feel like Hainel is a more. I'm sure they get more like pronounced each time. So, like, this is the middle series, so, like, he's a little more pronounced than the first one. But, yes, he is also, I forgot, did I not mention that he's, you know, a handsome 70s in like, a great 70s way? I think, you know, like, yeah, it's, like, obviously, as always, when I'm talking about robot series, I don't really focus a lot on, like, the robots, even though, like, they're great or whatever. Like, it's just not really, you know, what I'm watching for. But, you know, I just think that it has as far as like the monsters go, they're always like inventing new monsters to have to go after Voltus. So they're like the lieutenants of Hainel. I also really like all of them. And there's one in particular, Catherine, who is like, just lovely and like devoted and totally bananas. But they have kind of a ro-beast feel to them. If you've seen Voltron, where it's like, oh, you know, like we have to like experiment and like come up with the new like monster of the week. Sometimes they have really dramatic stories with them. Sometimes it's just a monster. Yeah, but I really loved how kind of the family dynamics and just the cultural dynamics in the series like come into like contention with each other. I just thought it was pretty great overall, and just like great opening song and ending song, like just knocking it out of the park. Oh, and to end, I always love to read out some episode titles, especially from old shows, because they are just like choice. So here's a few just to whet your appetite. The Tactic Revealed by the Grave. Abandon Love and Tears. Winnie, Beloved Horse Eiffel. The flame of hatred invites danger. And I will not read these other ones, but as per all series from, like, I don't know, at least up and through the, like, to the mid-90s, spoilers in episode titles of, like, this character dies.
So I have two questions for you, Kate. Who's your favorite male robot pilot?
Oh, Heinel doesn't count? Okay, I guess. He doesn't technically have a robot. No one.
That's fine. You could just... What do you call it? Megumi's the best.
Megumi only.
Yeah, that's fair. You're allowed to, yes. You're allowed to have that opinion. That's perfectly valid. And my second question is, you mentioned that it tackled systemic racism and other deep topics. Does it do it as well or slightly less well than Battle Athlete's Victory Restart, which...
Well, since I have not had the pleasure of experiencing any more Battle Athletes, I cannot make that comparison. Al, I think you'll have to watch Voltus 5 and let us know the answer to that.
Kate, I didn't have to watch it. The answer is Voltus 5. Because the other option is Battle Athlete's Victory Restart.
But I definitely recommend this. I had a lot of fun with it. It's kind of slightly on the shorter end as far as, like, if you're trying to watch an older robot series. And like I said, I think it has a little bit of a downswing, kind of like in the 20s. But otherwise, I think it's really, you know, pretty good all the way through. I don't know if I will be watching, like, Combattler V or Deimos. Although I have seen clips from Deimos that, again, make me very interested in it. But yeah, I would definitely, you know, if you're looking to get a better sense of older anime, I think this is, like, a great one. And a little bit, like, more under the radar than some of the other recommendations you might get from the 70s stuff.
One quick other question, Kate. So, because of how you set that up, who's hotter? The hot guy, hot antagonist from Voltus 5, or the hot, well, from what you've seen of the hot bad guy in Deimos?
The thing is that I feel like, how do I put this? Like, the problem with Heinel is that he's very committed to his racism. So it's not it's not like, I don't feel like he has, like, a big turn. Like, it's like, oh, you know, like, he's actually truly good inside or something. So I don't know if the character in Deimos is, like, a better person. Because I feel like, as much as, like, Heinel entertained me in his angriness, like, he's not, like, one of those villains who's, like, actually very noble. I mean, he's, like, a little bit, but not really. So he's not, like, actually good or something. So I feel like that diminishes his greatness by a lot.
That is 1,000% fair, Kate.
I can have moral. I can have principles. Like, I have a few.
She's like, I have principles. I also have eyes. Principles trump eyes. But eyes still exist.
I'll just say this for Richter. He does have wings, which, you know, is a fun addition. So, but I also have to get to know a character. It's hard for me to just...
That's fair, Kate. You're not one of these people who's just turned by character designs. I'm proud of you.
I mean, please. I am not that... I am definitely susceptible to such things. But yeah, if I was going to watch another one, I would probably watch Deimos. I think that's the other one. You know, I think people usually say, like, between, it's either Voltus 5 or Deimos is, like, the best of them.
Doro Hey Doro, which is definitely an interesting. You can't say, man, so many premise, you know, so many series have the premise where, everybody lives in, what do you call it, in a city where mages invade and, like, use their magic to experiment on people. And one guy has lost his memory after getting experimented on, and now he has a big lizard head. So he goes around swallowing, like, basically having his lizard head chomp on wizards that he catches, so the man who lives inside his head can tell him if this was the wizard that made him lose his memory and have a lizard head.
Seems really straightforward, Al.
Oh, and also, it's the story of the lady who runs the Goza place who helps him. Doro Hey Doro is definitely a weird show that, like, embraces its weirdness. Like, it realizes this world is odd. It realizes its characters are odd. And it just, like, doubles down on it. It was like, yep, I'm going to be a weird show and I'm going to be happy about it. Like, one of the guys could, like, one of the main wizards that we meet is Ein and his whole, like, gangster Ein family, and he can turn people into mushrooms and then enjoys making mushroom dishes out of them. And, like, and his whole, like, crew basically becomes, like, secondary protagonists of the series. Like his, like, two of his, like, chief enforcers constantly, the main guy is Kaiman. They, like, constantly mess with him and, like, clash with him. And, like, by the end, half an episode will be about Kaiman and his stuff, and the other half will be about the Ein family and what they're doing. The show is enjoyable, but I forgot what I was talking about the last time. Which is, it's definitely one of those shows. Oh, it was Otherworld Picnic. Where it's like, oh, you have comedy segments and you have, like, horror, like, body horror and, like, psychological horror and just gore. And you just switch between these and, like, in a way that makes perfect sense to you, but I'm not sure it's as effective as when you call it, you think so, mangaka. Because I feel like you're undercutting both tones at times. Like, other times it's like, alright, we've just had a lot of, like, horrible murder and gore. Time for some comedy. Alright, enough comedy. Back to, like, mystery and trauma. And then other times you're like, oh, you're just switching back and forth, like, these two things go together like peanut butter and jelly, and ooh. I don't think you realize that you're undercutting yourself at times here, show. Very unique setting. Some cool characters. Some cool mysteries. It's definitely one of those series that, like, slowly doles out the answers, and then when you get answers, it's really only, ah, now that you know this, here are three new mysteries that it opened up. Which is all very engaging. I wish the tone was more consistent, because, like, there is some good back and forth, and then there is some emotional, like, tonal whiplash. That's like, whoa, slow down there. You've, like, changed tone three times. This episode, to the point where I'm not exactly sure what you wanted me to feel at this end of the episode, but confused was definitely, emotionally confused, I'm pretty sure was not what you wanted me to feel. But it is definitely unique and mature, both in like kind of like sometimes like emotionally and sometimes in just kind of splatter gore. A flawed but interesting show is the way I'd best describe it. I feel like hopefully I've like intrigued those who would be intrigued, and hopefully warned away those who would get intrigued and then turned off.
I mean, I think this is another series where I've seen the manga and heard a lot of praise for the manga, but I assume the anime does not wrap anything up.
Oh no, every episode is like the like next episode. There is no next episode preview. It is just like, here is the mystery items that we learned, and like everything is like, and what do you call it? And the mysteries continue is basically how it ends every episode. So like, it like proudly declares that they have not wrapped anything up, and basically might as well just shout, go read the manga, fucker! At the last episode, like, yeah, I would say it wears as a badge of pride that it wraps nothing up. In fact, like, the last episode is just like a, hey, let's look at, like, it's just a random collection of some, like, backstory of popular characters that doesn't even answer. It's just like, let's look at some, like, formative moments in these popular characters' lives that don't really, like, what do you call it, answer any mysteries. It's just like a little insight into their characters. Peace.
You're saying it ends with a clip show?
It's like insight into their characters, so it's like new materials about like it's a little like backstory insight that's not in the main one. So it's not totally Chicken Chase, but it also is not any major, like, there's some, maybe some, like, little clues to further mysteries, but it's more, it was definitely, like, an OVA, kind of, like, more than, like, a next episode. I'm assuming they were like side story chapters, just all collected into one like final episode. Not that typical show that I feel like it's definitely going to have its fans, but also people who like after about 3 or 4 episodes just check out and do not want to return.
Where do you land?
I'm like very curious to see more. So I enjoyed it. I just wish the tone could be a little more consistent, or at least that it could transition between its tones a little smoother.
I'd be curious for you to read the manga, because maybe it worked. You know, I feel like some things work better in that space. I think, was it Helsing where they, initially, when they animated it, they took out like all the like goofy stuff, and then like, and people feel very mixed about like when they redid it and like put in the goofy stuff, and people are like, some people are like, yeah, and some people really didn't feel like it worked.
It feels like that stuff was in the original manga, but I haven't read it, so I could be wrong. Or maybe it does it smoother. I don't know. It feels like something inherent in the work.
Well, oh, you think they completely inserted it into the anime?
Oh no, I think the other way around. I feel like it was part of the manga. It feels to me, I could be wrong since I haven't read the manga, but it feels like it was part of the original manga. If anything, the only thing is maybe the director like transitioned clumsier, but I feel like that's more representative of how it was in the manga. But once again, it's editor, I could be wrong, but I'm getting the feeling that it wasn't like a botched adaptation. I just feel like that seemed like them just adapting the source material correctly. I feel like that's just the strange whiplash of tone of the original, but
I wasn't implying that they inserted it. I was just saying that like some things
work better and on the
feel print. Less jarring. Yeah, like I just think that sometimes similar to that's why I brought up Helsing, because I think some people didn't mind it as much in the manga, whereas then like people in the anime were like, what the hell is this? Like it doesn't. And like maybe it's simply like a page turn where you don't have a page turn in an anime. I don't know. Anyway, I'd just be curious if you got the same feeling or not from the manga or anyone else. If anybody's, I know it's a fairly popular manga, so if any listeners have read the manga, I'd be curious to hear what you think.
I do wonder if you're right, that maybe it's one of those things that just works better on the page. That would be very interesting to see. I'm very curious. I should read a few chapters just to see if that is the case.
Okay, so I thought we'd wrap up with another blast from the past. I have started rewatching the Lum movies, and coincidentally, Al also mentioned that, I recently rewatched one of the movies also, so it kind of worked itself out. I've recently rewatched the first two, so the first one is Only You, and the second one is the incredibly famous Beautiful Dreamer. Both of the first and second movies that I watched are directed by Oshii, but they're very different from each other.
I watched movie 5, which is the final chapter, which adapts basically the last Lum storyline. There is a movie after that one, but it's just like an anniversary movie, and it's just like a random made-up story, and it's generally considered one of the weaker movies, if I remember correctly. I only vaguely remember watching it. I don't even remember it. So it was forgettable enough that I mainly forgot even what it's about. And you know my general Rurikuro Takahashi love, so it's got to be pretty blah for me to be like, I don't remember. I definitely saw it, but it wore off a duck's back.
And I don't know if, were you spurned to watch it, Al, because they put them up on Crunchyroll?
Yes.
Is that, because that's sort of what, that is the same thing for me when they announced that. Not that I don't, like, own some of these movies, but I was like, oh, like, that makes me want to rewatch or revisit them.
Yeah, I saw that the movies were up, and I was like, oh, I'll watch what do you call it, the last chapter again. That's, like, one of my favorite ones. And I'm sure I'll just have a day that I'm, like, depressed or bored, and I'll just pop it, you know, like,
And I think before the podcast, we were talking about Lum or Urusei Yatsura, and Al made the good point that I think this is the only part of the anime that's, like, accessible streaming right now are the movies. So for anybody who either has never experienced the series, like, this is really the only thing that you can get at the moment. With any movies for a long-running series, I think you always get kind of a mixed bag of, like, some people, you know, some are going to be great, some are less so, and then everybody has favorites, and, like, I think people discuss a lot about, like, what is representative of the series and such. And it's very interesting that certainly when in the 90s, most people had seen Beautiful Dreamer, and they had not seen Beautiful Dreamer because they were big Lum fans or they were big fans of Marussia Tsura. One, it was one of the few that was like readily accessible at like any rental place would like always have that one movie. And it was also, again, Mamoru Oshii. And so, you know, they could get away with being like, the Ghost in the Shell director, don't you want to see Beautiful Dreamer? Like, as if those things are deeply related to each other. But, you know, interestingly enough, I think the first movie is much more representative of, like, what the Lum series is like. Like, it's this romp. You know, it's everybody acting like an idiot. There's a lot of miscommunication. But it's still like really, because it's a movie, I think it's like got really great animation. And also it has this weird, like both the first movie and the second movie, and Al, you'll have to speak to like if this follows into the rest of the movies because I can't remember. But the movies, you can clearly tell that the animation staff was like really into like the technology and the like spaceships, and there's like a lot of, and it's like this is like nothing, not important at all. Like this is irrelevant to the actual plot of this comedy, romantic comedy series. Like that's what this show actually is. But like the staff working on it was clearly, you know, like just like very 80s into like drawing machines and technology.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are people who are like super disappointed that that like has gone away. Really interesting, like that after Beautiful Dreamer got such acclaim, movies 3 and 4 definitely try to recapture that kind of like try to recapture the feel of Beautiful Dreamer. Like they're a lot more dreamlike and experimental and kind of off the beaten path. I don't think they ever work as well. And then 5 definitely feels very much return to form. I mean, it, you know, they're adapting the last story. It feels very much more like a traditional Lum story. Because, like, yeah, like, I remember, like, 4 is about, like, a weird tree, and I forget what 3 is about. But, yeah, they definitely, like, after 2, they definitely try to, like, recapture that Beautiful Dreamer spirit and without Oshii and never do. And then, once again, 6 is utterly forgettable.
It's just so interesting, though, because, like I said, the first movie, I think, is pretty, like, this is what the series is like if you watch the TV series. But Beautiful Dreamer is, like, pretty much nothing like it. And it's so weird because they're both the same director, of course. And the first one is, like, him making a Lum movie. And the second one is, like, him making a movie where Lum characters make an appearance. Like, he's like, I guess they have to be in this movie that I'm making because that's the rules. But like the beginning part of the story is all focused on like Sakura and like, you know, like two like adult teacher characters are like really driving things at the beginning of the story for quite a while. And it has this super ominous tone from the beginning, which is, of course, nothing is very ominous about this wacky comedy series usually. And there's, again, there's like a lot of technology. It ends up being like having this whole like huge segment that's very like post-apocalyptic. Dreams and nightmares, like there's like moments that are very Lum, but like I think like overall it's not really Like it's an interesting movie. It's a good movie, but like, is it a love movie? I don't know. Like, it's just like this. It's a strange movie, I guess. And there were things about it that I didn't remember, like the beginning. There, is the school festival, and basically, kind of the plot at the beginning is that this one day keeps repeating. Nobody, and there's like. Finally, somebody notices that, like, they just keep repeating this day, and like, what's going on, and why is that happening? But, like, it's this like the night before the school festival, and everybody's running around and doing a lot of, last minute prep, and everybody's together, and this like very special moment, usually for like clubs and like memorable moment for school. But for some reason, all of the cast in here, their project for the school festival is a Third Reich cafe. I was like, why? Why? Didn't remember that at all. Okay. No, it's not okay. It was really like in poor taste. I don't know what that was about. And then all, but then Hitler comes up again. Hitler comes up multiple times in this movie. Very weird. And the other thing that I think is both weird and interesting is that despite like what I feel like is Oshii not really wanting to like tell a Lum story, he does do an incredibly excellent job of defining Ataru's relationship to Lum in this movie. Like, I feel like he does do a really good job of like summing that up. So I guess all of his time working on this series, whether he wanted to or not, he at least got it. What's your stance on Beautiful Dreamer, Al?
I enjoy it. But it, 'cause when you watched it, you were showing someone who hadn't seen any Lum before, and I feel like it always feels like a Macross Plus in that, like, it's enjoyable, but it's a bad introduction to the series as a whole, because it has a very different tone. Or at least I know there are people who swear by introducing people to Macross with Macross Plus, but I feel it's always risky because you're introducing something that has a tone that the rest of most of the other things that you're going to introduce them to with the main body of the franchise is it's un incongruous with that. Thereby, I feel like it's much better to have the what you did, which is the Only You and then Beautiful Dreamer. So you're like, all right, this is what love normally is, and then this is this weird kind of one-off tangent that's definitely worth watching, but is not representative of the series as a whole. I mean, I think the final chapter is probably my favorite of the movies. But I mean, I know most people would like argue that the final chapter is kind of more conventionally directed, and is it the masterwork that is Two? And I like Two. I think it's a good movie. I enjoy it. I've watched it multiple times. But you could probably argue it's the better movie, but I mean, final chapter has always just had a, I don't know, I was like that story. It was kind of like this journey, because I started with one of the anime that really got me into anime was Ranma, and then I really wanted to see other work by Rumiko Takahashi, and it took me so long to like track down more Lum, and then Animigo, and I could only watch like random episodes that I would find, and then Animigo licensed it, and I was finally able to watch it all, and it was kind of like this end of a journey for me. So like it kind of has like this, I don't know, has like a little bit of a special place that maybe gives it a little more weight in my memory, in my heart, than maybe possibly it deserves independent of it, but I don't know. I'm allowed to feel how I feel.
Well, now I'm really excited to watch the rest of the movies. Just because, like, watching these two just made me kind of, just fall in love with this group of idiots once again. And now I'm like, knowing that the fifth one is your favorite, I do you feel like you can watch the final chapter without? I mean, it's not exactly the like Urus Yatsura, for those who have never seen it, is not exactly like some deep plot. So, do you feel like you can, take in the final chapter without really worrying a whole lot about anything else?
It's not that hard to follow along. The only thing that you miss is she went out of her way to kind of have a lot of parallels between like the first story and the last story, because they have to play tag again, but now we call it Ataru and Lum are on the outs, and so like the game of tag at the end has a very different meaning and the such, and but it's like, but it's very clearly supposed to like call back to the original story. So it's like we were just having a discussion before the podcast about like Critical Role and watching like the first camp second campaign without having watched the first campaign, and what you how much is it vital and how much do you miss out of it. And I feel like I don't feel like you'd be lost or miss that much, but there is a kind of there's a little bit more of an added weight, and like if you've seen at least the first few stories, since they're like supposed to be a little more of bookends, and that gives it a little more weight, and I think also helps me was my own personal thing. So I don't think you'd, be like, ah, if you, this movie is trash, and then you watch the first, you watch the first few episodes. Ah, no, now I realize it's excellent. It's just, those parallels do, give it a little extra depth. But, I mean, it's Lum. It's never that deep. As much as I love that series, it's never that deep. Yeah, I mean, you could watch it. I just think you'll there's a like a little extra dimension that's missing if you haven't seen the whole series.
Well, they are, even though I mentioned, you can't really watch any of the other anime, the manga is being released in these nice volumes, so you could read the first, the you know like kind of the originating story, and then you could watch this movie if you don't know kind of the beginnings of it.
And you could learn that originally Shinobu was supposed to be the main character of the manga.
Womp womp.
The main love interest, I should say. And what I've seen of those books, they're very nice. They're excellently done. Until Viz cancels it again.
Not this time. Not this time. All right. Well, that wraps up another episode of the Speakeasy, and I think that's the next episode. Al and I will be recording together in the same place again for the first time in a year and a half.
We almost recorded this one in the same place at the same time, but for reasons not even worth getting into, just the scheduling and a whole bunch of other stuff, we had to, we were going to record in real life, and then stuff happened, and now we had to record over, Discord. But with any luck, next time you will see us back in the same room recording.
And it actually is a good time to do it because we will be ushering in a new anime season, I think, by that point. It will be the summer 21 season, so it's a good time to be together. So we'll go back. We'll see if the dynamic changes. I don't know. I don't know if anybody has been able to tell that we haven't been. I mean, we've obviously mentioned that we haven't been recording together, but I mean, I don't know if there's any noticeable difference, but we're certainly looking forward to being able to be together again. So
see you in July, which is also the anniversary of the blog
and Al's birthday.
Many joyous occasions.